Welcome to A Longer Table Podcast, a space where curiosity and proximity will challenge everything you thought you knew. I'm your host, Amanda Carpenter, inviting you to pull up a seat. You just might leave thinking, maybe we're not so different. Today, we're going to be talking about the craft of writing and tips for aspiring authors. So if you are a writer, you're going to love this conversation. I brought the editor of my last book, Soul Care to Save Your Life, to the table. Her name is Stephanie Duncan Smith. She is an executive editor at Baker Books, and she is amazing, you guys. She's been working in publishing for many years. She's developed best-selling and award-winning writers. She has a newsletter that I'll talk about in the conversation called Slant Letter. We'll link everything in our show notes. But on a personal note, Stephanie lives on the East Coast with her husband and their toddler daughter. So you're going to love her, and I think you're going to find her tips so practical. Enjoy this. All right, before Stephanie joins the table, I have to tell you guys about Aro. You've probably heard me talk about it before if you've been listening to this podcast for any length of time or if you follow me on social media, but it especially pertains to today's conversation because as a writer, as a creator, I have to be present. I have to be off my device. I cannot be attached to my phone at all times, scrolling, looking at other people's content, comparing. It's honestly the biggest killer to my creativity and to my writing practice. And so if you're like, what the heck is Aro? It is an app and a device that you have in your home. So you download the app to your phone, you get the device. The device looks like this pretty white box. It sits on my bar cart in our house. So it's like something that you can have out. It looks good. And you put your phone in there. It charges your phone, but that's not all it does. It actually tracks through the app how much your time is plugged in. And it's more than just a place where you leave your phone. It's an invitation to presence. What's really cool about it is when you unplug your phone from the Aro, you log what you were doing so you can keep track. Like, I was reading a book. I was writing a chapter. I was playing with Shia. I was, you know, having quality conversation with E. Like, I love logging it. It's so motivating to me. So if, like me, you want to be off your phone as much as possible, Aro's for you. For $12 to $18 a month, Aro is worth giving a try. That comes down to like $3 to $4 a week just to have the opportunity for family dinners without distraction, vulnerable conversations with your spouse or kids, to finally start reading that book or writing that book that you may not have had time for otherwise. So I would love for you to check it all out for yourself at goaro.com. Get your first month free on an annual or two-year membership with code Manda. Now to the conversation with Stephanie. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us at the table. When I thought of who was like an expert at speaking to the craft of writing and tips for aspiring authors and people like myself who have been writing their whole life, I thought of you. I was like, there is no one better for this conversation than Stephanie Smith. So thank you so much for being here.
So glad to be here.
Yeah, I have told so many people about your Slant Letter. You know that I love it. That's your letter on Substack, so we'll make sure to link it. But I thought we could start with that. Really, how does someone find their slant, or in other words, their unique writing voice?
I love that question. So I'll answer it in two parts because I actually think that your slant is very similar but distinct from your voice. And how I differentiate that, I think your writing voice is how you say what you say. So in the very same way that our physical voices have distinctive markers, when I pick up the phone, I know exactly who I'm talking to because of the sound of their voice. It sounds like nobody else's. And that's true in the writing voice as well. There's certain kind of tones and styles and just the personality comes out in that unique way. So your voice is how you sound, but I think the angle is what you're saying. So I would differentiate that to say your angle is what you have to say and your voice is how you say it. And ideally, and when writing, I think really gets us in the gut, those two things go together. And they do naturally. And so I would say if we're sequencing it, finding your voice, or let's say kind of refining your voice and coming into your voice that's uniquely you, that to me will always come first. Mm-hmm. And then finding your unique angle will come after that. Because the truth is, if you write 30 books in a lifetime, it'll all be your voice. But ideally, it would be 30 different unique angles. So similar, but separate, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah, I'm glad you made that distinction. I know for me, like, I have struggled to find my voice sometimes. And honestly, the longer I write, I think the more secure or grounded I feel in my voice. And I kind of stop overthinking it, maybe.
Yeah.
But especially, like, I look back 8 years ago, and similar to my personality, it's kind of, or not my personality, more my mood, let's say, you're going to get a different tone from me depending on the mood or the place that I'm writing from. Sure. So yeah, without going into too much detail, I resonate with other people who say they struggle with this. Do you have any other, like, tips of how do we then stay consistent in our voice, mm-hmm. even though life circumstances change, moods happen, like,
yeah,
so much around us is changing. How do we stay consistent and true to our voice?
Yeah, I think it's a process of learning first to really listen to yourself and what's genuine in yourself, as opposed to absorbing styles and voice tones that might be popular or that you might just genuinely love in someone else. There's plenty of voices that I love, and I'm like, I'm obsessed with their voice. It's not mine. It's not me. So, you know, loving something doesn't necessarily mean that that's genuine to you. So I think it's a process of learning to listen to yourself and get in touch with yourself. I like the exercise, just to make it really practical, I really like the exercise of trying to put 3 descriptive words to your voice. Mm. You know, I'm whatever, my voice is, it's authoritative, it's bold, it's funny, it's cheeky, it's reflective or contemplative. There's so many different descriptors, and trying to narrow that down into, okay, this is what I sound like. This sounds like me, into 3 words. And to even take that further, I like to make these things as tangible as possible, because so much of our lives are digital. So
totally.
I would say, like, pop those words on a post-it note and stick it on your laptop screen so that they're always staring at you. Or, you know, write it as a headline in top of your notebook or your planner, but write it down in your own handwriting, which is also a unique expression of a voice in some ways, in physical form, visible form. And that can be a really profound exercise. It can also help to narrow it down to say this, not that. Mm. To say, like, I'm, you know, just to give you examples, but I'm like, maybe I'm funny, my voice is funny, but it's never sarcastic, or it's, you know, contemplative, but it's never inaccessible. Mm-hmm. So just getting as specific as you can, that can be a great way to do it. And if you're scouting for inspiration, one possibility, you can always look at the endorsements or the reviews of books that you love. How do people describe this writer's voice? And is there anything that makes you kind of light up and say, like, ooh, yeah, that's exactly what I'm going for?
I like that. That's such a good practical tip. And I also love that you acknowledge when we gravitate towards someone's voice, or we really adore their writing and their voice, it's easy to kind of, if we're not careful, sort of replicate or really try mm-hmm. to mimic. And
while that doesn't seem maybe that harmful, I think it actually distracts us from reaching the people that we're supposed to reach with our true voice. Definitely been a struggle for me. So just kind of like owning that here and saying if that's a struggle for someone listening, I totally get it. It's why I've had to like mute some people's posts on social media for a while, because I find myself going, oh, I want to do exactly what they're doing. And then it's like, well, wait a second. I don't have to carbon copy someone else, you know? Right. I know they say imitation is the highest form of flattery and all of that, but I want to just do what comes unique to me, to Manda.
Okay. I love something you said too about just the I think the value of practice. I think that's something you mentioned, and this is a process that is refined and strengthened through practice. So none of that time is wasted as you're, if you're like, I don't really know what my voice is. I don't even know where to start with that. That's okay. That's a process to be honored and explored and discover. And like you said, practice it and you'll find out. So that's that can't lead you wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Experiment, try some things. Yeah. Put yourself out there. I love it. All right. This is kind of a big question, but I'm so curious to what you're going to say. I have some ideas of what you might say, but we'll see if I'm right. Okay. What is one thing someone should do to become a better writer? If you could say, do one thing, what would it be?
This is going to sound so obvious, but I'm going to stand by it. It's read like crazy. And we're talking about, you know, the difference between, carbon copy imitation and learning from, but, there is so much to be learned from great writing. And I'll get specific into that. I would suggest the one thing to make you, if you want to become a better writer, don't just read a bunch of books, but commit yourself to being an active reader. And what I mean by that is read, not just as a reader, but as a student of the craft of what's working and why. Like really pop the hood and ask yourself as you're reading, why am I so taken with this story? What about this sentence makes me want to tattoo it on my arm? What in this introduction is pumping me up to, I can't wait to read the rest of this book? Those are the questions that I think writers bring to their reading practice. And there's just so much that you can take from that. And I see it every time I read for a living, and I can see the readers in their writing, because you can't help but take it all in by osmosis, but then also being intentional about, okay, why did this move me? What are the actual tactics and tools and methods being used here? Not that you can copy paste, but the principles that you can learn from, and then that can lead you into your best writing. Something I love to do, it's hard for me to turn off the editing brain, even when I'm just reading for fun. But I like to annotate in my margins just notes for me on that exact question, like, why is this working? What are they doing here? Can we name the principle that is making me underline this sentence? So just getting really curious and becoming a student through reading wonderful works, I think is the best thing you can do.
Yeah, I love that. That was one of two things that I thought you might say. And I agree with it. In my experience, when I'm in a really good rhythm, when I'm in really good rhythms of reading, I just feel more inspired to write. It's like the words come to me a little more easily, I think. Because I've noticed, like, just full transparency, I'm in a season where I'm not reading as much, I'm not even writing as much, and I'm kind of just feeling a little bit of just in a creative rut, maybe. And so I told myself that I'm going to go to the library and pick out like 2 to 3 fiction books. Cause for me, fiction, which is usually different from what I'm writing, I tend to write nonfiction. If I can read fiction, it usually just kind of pulls me out of my head and gets me back into the practice. But
writing's huge. Yeah. And I think there's so much wisdom to that too. It's not just a pragmatic means to an end practice. It's really, reading is a way of coming back to your first love, which for all of us, if you identify as a writer, I'm pretty sure it's because you loved reading first. Otherwise, I don't know why you would care. And I think that's such a beautiful practice of stepping out of the mode of production, or I have to, you know, make something, and just settling into a story that you love, you know, and letting yourself come alive to that, and then letting that lead wherever it will. I love that. And I wish more people did it. So I'm glad that you're doing that for yourself right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. I am curious who or what influences your writing, Stephanie, because like I've said, your newsletter is where I currently read your words, and I appreciate them so much. And they're so practically helpful, but also like the way you string sentences together is stunning. It's poetic almost. It's really beautiful. And you can tell that these are not newsletters that you just kind of throw together in 10 minutes of your, you know, at the end of your day. This is like thoughtful, really meaningful and important work. So thank you. And I'm curious who or what is influencing your writing there and other places.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a great question. And you can't see all the spines behind me, but the answers are all back there. I think a couple directions. One writer that has influenced my work a lot in terms of just the aspirational is Annie Dillard. And if you know her, she wrote many books, but Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, and one of her smallest but most potent books that I love is called Holy the Firm. And a couple of things I've taken from her. She writes with the density of a poet. And I think I like that. Holy the Firm is this tiny little book, but it's packed as if it were written as a poem. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm drawn to the craft of that and the challenge of how can you bring as much significance into so few words. Mm. I think that's the practice of poetry. And I love her example in that. I don't really identify as a poet. I used to, as maybe like a kid or a high schooler. And it's not something that it's not a form that I do a lot in the traditional way, but I do think that those practices of significance in succinct form are really powerful to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm always noticing that in just sentences that I'm underlining in any book. It's like, wow, they just took this huge, immense idea and put it into this single line that will stay with me. And that's powerful. So that's one thing. And then also, Annie Dillard she's like a naturalist writer. She draws a lot from the natural world. And I love the reading experience of that. But also, she's just very incredibly earnest in a way that, granted, is not going to be everybody's cup of coffee. I know, you know, she has like a famous essay about encountering a weasel in the woods. Depending on who you ask, some people think it's the most profound thing they've ever read. And other people are like, this is just weird, Annie. You saw wildlife in the forest and you had a spiritual, I don't get it. This is like a little over the top. But I think that there's a great permission in that, you know what, this is her voice. And if that feels over the top to someone else, to her, it's really profound. And to some people, it will be over the top. And to some people, it will be profound. And that's fine. So I think that's one. I could give you a ton of examples, but one other, and I'm just drawing from kind of the classics because they're they speak for themselves. But Madeline L'Engle is another enduring influence for the ways that she was unafraid to write into paradox, and she just, even as a public figure, she was way too religious for a lot of people, and then for Christians, she was way too out there, and that didn't bother her. So I think, you know, writers who are able to write into the paradox and tension are always of interest to me. And these examples and others, I think what influences my writing. I love it when any writer is brave enough to, when they know their voice enough and they're secure enough in that to just kind of own their weirdness. That is always so striking to me. And that can look like completely different expressions, but the common thread is they're like, this is who I am. This is what my voice sounds like. This is what I'm into. You can take it or leave it. Yeah. And I just think that there's a distillation that happens when a writer is unconcerned with how readers, with pleasing everyone, because you can never please everyone.
Yes.
So that is always inspiring to me.
Yeah. Snaps. I'm with you. That's good stuff. And it's hard work to get to that place. But I think it's even less about the work as a writer and more about the work as a human on a soul level to be able to get to a place where you're unashamedly fully yourself at the table in every form.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
We'll get back to the conversation after this quick advertisement. My favorite pieces in my wardrobe come from Able. Not only is every piece super cute and high quality, but there's a meaningful mission behind this woman-run company. Able is making the table longer by adding more sizes. They offer apparel in double extra small to 3X. And I have to tell you about their size swap program. It's simple yet profound. When your size changes, such as postpartum, or when you've gone through a long period of grief, when you've started a new workout routine, Able will allow you to swap yours for another size. Take a look at their Basics We Love section, and you'll see a lot of the things I wear every day. Next time you're in need of a new pair of pants or tops, shop ableclothing.com and use code ALONGERTABLE15 for 15% off. Now, back to the show.
All right. You are obviously, you've been in publishing for a long time. You've worked with seasoned authors. You've worked with rookie authors like myself. What would you say is a common mistake, and maybe not author specific, but writers in general, what would be a common mistake you see amateur writers making?
Yeah. I think two things come to mind that I see a lot. The first is not making room for your reader. And I'll qualify that just to say, if you're writing for yourself, if you are writing as a personal practice or in the privacy of your own journal, with no plans for your writing to be public, then you don't have a reader and you don't have to make room for them. And I fully support that. And honestly, I think that writing for you, it's almost as if your first draft, you're always going to be writing for yourself, because you need to work this out in your own head. And I think that's as it should be. But so I'll qualify that just to say, if you're writing for your own self-expression without an audience, you don't need to make room for your reader. There isn't one, that's fine. But if you do want to write for the benefit of other people, you will have to go through the layered process of making space for them in the scope and narrative of what you have to say. So that's a big one. And I, you know, in my work as an editor, I see this a lot. many personal narratives, whether it's kind of an anecdote or it's a straight chronological memoir. Many of them, most of them, start with writing the scene for yourself. And again, that's as it should be. I don't think you can write it for other people if you haven't written it for yourself first, or I don't think it will be very good if you skip that. So I think that's so important and you can't skip it. But then the goal is always to move toward your reader. And you can tell an intensely personal story that's very first person centric. I, me. And it's possible for that to reach your reader in a way that they also feel seen and spoken to. But that's the craft and the creative task. So I think that's a common mistake. And it's not unfixable. It's actually very fixable. It's because if you've written for yourself first, you've done step one. That's done. And that's wonderful. And then you're ready to do the work of translating it from the particularities of your experience to the universal human experience. I think so much of my work happens in that translation. And it's really just as simple as bringing the wisdom of whatever you've learned to your reader and for their benefit and enrichment. And doing so is in the spirit that's true to you and along your table, it's an act of hospitality. It's just making room for them too, instead of kind of keeping the mic to yourself. It's passing it to them too and holding up a mirror to their experience too. So that's a really big one.
Yeah. No, that's great. And I work with I've worked with now 5 people who've self-published, walked them through a program that I sort of created based on my own process when I first self-published. It's mm-hmm. been so fun because they're people who don't necessarily have a platform and they're not really interested in doing the work to cultivate the platform and the newsletter right. and all the things. And so they just maybe had a dream. Like one, for example, is a mom who she really wanted to write a children's book for her kids. And if it reached other people, she's was all about that. But that was like her primary goal. So she was a perfect candidate for what I was offering. And we worked together. And even in that process and with others that have written memoirs, for example, you're right. The first draft, it's like, I always just say it's the crappy first draft. Like just get it out because I can work with something, but I can't work with nothing. Mm-hmm. And it is oftentimes very, I don't want to say self-centered because that sounds a little wonky, but just it, you just have to get it out.
Yeah.
And then the work of like refining and editing and revisiting it is like massaging out. Okay. Now thinking about this through the lens of somebody who's going to read it. What do you want them to take away? Do you want them to take away that your grandma made that soup, or do you want them to take away something deeper? Like this isn't just about them learning stories of your life. Right. What's the underlying thing here? And it's been such fun work. So I like feel like I've gotten a little bit of taste of the other side of the journey, maybe more the side that you're on with a lot of your authors. Mm-hmm. And I am loving it. I'm like, should I have been an editor? This is so fun. This is really yeah. fun work.
Yeah. Well, yeah, bringing in some fresh eyes it's amazing what can happen. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. You did that for me. And I am so grateful because Soul Care to Save Your Life would not be what it is without you. And the others who got to have their fingerprints on it as well.
And you had that gift from the beginning too, I have to say, writing for your reader. That was not something that I needed to coach you on. And that's, I think that's just how you approach your work, but it comes through. It comes through.
Well, thank you. There was a lot of other stuff I needed help on. So it worked out. I know people listening, some of them listening, they have the dream of being an author someday, but it seems like everybody's an author, or at least people who the industry I think has shifted. And now if you have this big platform or you've been the winner of a season on The Bachelor, suddenly you have a book, whether or not you've written it or it was ghostwritten, like everyone has a book. Is there room for me to be successful? I think that's the mm-hmm. question people, especially ordinary people like myself, are wondering. Is there still room? Because I don't know if I'll ever sell 10,000 copies. I mean, I'm trying, but is there room? What are your thoughts?
Yeah. It's a big question. It's a good one. So the first thing that I think of when you say that is, what is meant by successful? Mm. Yes. I am not into overpromising. So I don't want to stand here as part of the publishing industry gatekeeping and tell you, yeah, of course there's room for you. I cannot downplay the work. I don't have to tell you this, but I cannot and I will not downplay what publishing in today's environment requires of a person. And just the mental, creative, emotional, everything, energy, time, it asks so much of you. So I can't be glib about that. Mm-hmm. But I can ask, what does it mean to be successful? And I think so for so many authors or aspiring authors, there's a sense in which getting the book deal and getting your words into print is the end goal. And I would challenge that only to say, take it deeper, because a lot of people get book deals. A lot of people, is there room for that for you? Probably, if that's something you want, but think really granularly, maybe a year out from your on sale date, you get up, you make your coffee, and you're like, wow, a year ago today, my book came out into the world. What needs to have taken place for you to feel really good about that and proud of yourself and proud of what you've contributed? I understand that in the industry side of things, like in my seat, we have access to all sorts of information, sales-wise and history-wise and market-wise, that not everyone has on the writer side. But I would say, think really specifically about, well, okay, what kind of book do you want to publish? What kind of publisher? Self-published, do you want to do it yourself? Are you happy with a small press or, you know, an academic press? Or do you want, you know, a big imprint? Do you want to hit bestseller lists? Like, what does success to you look like? And then as much as you can educate yourself about this, I would say think about a sales threshold that would feel successful to you. And maybe another way of asking that is, what kind of success would feel meaningful to you? What could you feel proud of at the end of the day? And what also feels, be a realist, be relentlessly a realist. So I think educating yourself as much as you possibly can. In publishing, we talk about comp titles a lot. So, you know, authors with similar platforms, similar reaches, maybe similar messages. Find out as much as you can about those to get a gauge and reference points for what might be doable for you. And then get really honest with yourself. It's easy to want the big things. Everybody wants the big things. And if I could gently poke the bubble of a lot of aspiring authors, this is a big mindset that's out there. And it's this idea that, like, I don't know, magic happens sometimes and all the stars align and maybe it'll be me. And we all want to believe that. It's easy and it's not wrong to want that or to think that maybe that'll be you. But it's also a really fast, sure way to set yourself up for disappointment when you have a very vague but very big idea of what success is. And then it all sifts down into the details and you realize that it wasn't what you hoped for. So I think a great goal for anyone with any kind of ambition is figure out and name what it would take to be proud of yourself at the end of the process. Get as specific as you can to that, because then a year later or whatever, you know, as time goes by, you can sit back and say, like, I did what I came to do, and I held nothing back. And you can't control the results, but you can control your investment. And as we've acknowledged, it's an investment. It asks so much of you. So I would say just be, it's an expectation setting practice to say, what do I want and why? Get specific as you can about that. And also, you know, level with yourself about what it will cost in your time, in the shape of your life, in your expenses, in your mental and emotional space and energy capacity. And often I see a mismatch between what writers are willing to invest and you know, reality check on what it will cost them and high hopes. So being really level with yourself about those, the distance between those two things. So that's a lot of takeaways. It's a big conversation. It's a huge question. Is there room? Yes, but only you can define what success looks like to you. Yeah. And it might not be what you want. But what do you want is the biggest question, I think.
Yeah. It's really good. I mean, I agree with like everything you're saying. I think one of the things that I took away from my traditional publishing journey is I wished that I had set really realistic and just concrete goals around pre-orders, for example. I'll just use that as the example.
It's a great example. Yeah.
I think there was no number in my mind, but what they amounted to was a letdown to me. And I wasn't sure why, because actually when I started looking into things, and you know, you look at email subscriber numbers, you look at social media numbers, which don't always translate to sales and readers and buyers. Right. You know, you kind of start to look into that and I'm going, oh, I don't know why I'm beating myself up. This really isn't that, this isn't some huge letdown. I can't expect pre-orders to be, let's say, 7,000 when there aren't that many people engaging with my content regularly. I don't know, like things like that. So I appreciate you saying that. And I agree. I think there's room because there is always the option to self-publish. You don't have to meet the qualifications to get in the room with traditional publishing. And there's so much beauty to that, because I really think one of the best ways to, let's say you have a goal of someday being traditionally published. I know this like helped me. Yeah. I started by self-publishing because then it was like, oh, I can sell. This is selling. People are reading this and they're buying this. And also, I believe that we don't quote unquote grow a following by just putting our effort into quote unquote growing a following. I think a following sort of starts to come along when you're just putting out really valuable information or creative, beautiful work, whatever it is that people find valuable and they want more of. Mm-hmm. That is the key. So I think a lot of us are asking maybe the wrong question when it comes to writing or whatever it is that the end goal of your creative pursuit is. I think we know sometimes that there's all these like steps or milestones that we need to like achieve to get there, but we focus our energy on those things instead of, if you actually want to be a writer, well, you should start writing. That's the first thing, and reading, and maybe start putting some stuff out there and let that speak for itself. Let that generate some readers. And I think we like withhold because we think we need to have the numbers first, but I think the numbers come after you start putting content out. I don't know if that fully made sense. That's my verbal process.
I think it's you have to be willing to lead a conversation, and that the best books come out of that. If you are leading a conversation that people are interested in, that they want to speak into, that kind of engages them, that's a great place to start. And it's the best place for books to come out of. because what a book is hopefully a deepening of that conversation and an immersive reading experience. So I think that's a great place to start. And also, you know, that it's a good prompt. If you want to publish someday, but you're like, I don't want to be in conversation with strangers on the internet for, you know, hours of my week. I don't actually want to do that. Now would be a good time to get honest with yourself about that, because maybe that's not the medium for you. And maybe the medium for you is writing articles that are short form and you can submit and they're done, or a local format, bringing people into live in-person conversation in ways that are meaningful to you and can serve them where they are. It can look like, I think what we want can look like so many different things. Mm-hmm. And this is something we talk a lot about in our editorial reviews of new proposal. A comment that will come up every now and then is, we love this idea, but we're not convinced that it's a book. Mm. It'd make a great speaking lecture or in-person event or, you know, newsworthy article, but we're not convinced that a long form book is the right medium for it. It doesn't mean it doesn't matter. That's only one metric. It's only one expression of what a beautiful and, you know, powerful conversation can be. So, I think that's worth thinking too. Is the book the right format? Is it the right medium for what you want? Or does that look like something different that maybe needs reimagining?
Good. Yeah, it's really good wisdom. Well, as we wrap up here, I thought it would be fun to just ask, because there are people listening who probably are on track or are trying to pursue traditional publishing. So no one better to ask than you, what are some qualities that you look for or that you really like to see in authors that you take on that you want to work with?
Yeah, I love that question. I think putting some language to a lot of what we've already been talking about, I am always looking for authors who take ownership of their authorship. And to me, that's, you've done the work of thinking through what you want and how you're going to get there. And you own your responsibility for that, as much as you're open to the partnership and collaboration that is working with a traditional publisher. I think that's a huge, I respect that because I know how much work it takes. And I love it when an author not only has the vision for their path, but has done the work of getting granular about, okay, what does that look like? And what are the stepping stones that belong to me along the way? That's wonderful. That speaks for itself. And that makes for a great partnership because, you know, when everybody's bringing their best, we can do a lot together. So that's one. I would also say just doing the work of really looking at the market, what's working, what's not working, and how you can, this comes back to my, you know, the angle, saying what you have to say in the boldest expression that you possibly can. And I never expect a proposal to be print ready ever. The working titles are working titles for a reason. There's so much workshopping and creative process that, so I never look at a proposal with the expectation that it's ready to go. But I love to see that an author has been like, okay, there's these three other books on this topic, but here's how mine is different and stands out. That speaks volumes to be able to articulate that. And it gets me excited in a way that, you know, editors see a lot of proposals. So we've probably seen, you know, there's only so many kind of human topics that books are written on. And there is a huge room and range, because we need to be reminded of what's true again and again in different forms and voices. Mm-hmm. But looking for that fresh factor. And it's a process, but when I see it on the page, that is so exciting to me and a true standout factor in, like, okay, you have my attention because I hadn't thought of that before. That's really great. And just doing your research to differentiate what your message is from what's out there currently. And also, we're talking about conversations. What are the conversations people are having today? And how can you be at the leading edge of that by saying something that is truly fresh and gets our attention? It starts with the editor's spark, who's really just a stand-in for your reader. But if it's sparking to me, it's going to spark to readers.
Yeah.
So that speaks really, really strongly.
Yeah, it's good. Well, this was all so helpful. And I know I feel very inspired as a writer listening to it. So I hope those listening feel the same way. There's a lot of questions and nitty-gritty things we didn't get into about publishing and writing, but I love that we covered so much. I hope this was helpful. And thank you, Stephanie, for joining us and just sharing all this wisdom. You've been in publishing for a long time, and you are highly sought after and well held in such high regard by myself and so many of my peers. So we just adore you and appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you for having me, and just rooting for you all in this big work, whatever expression that takes. But we need good writing, so keep at it.